Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Francis Alonso reporting. At least seven people were killed in Burundi's capital, Bujumbura, during a night of violence in districts where months of protests took place against President Pierre Nkurunziza, according to police and witnesses. Residents said police shot and killed five men after house-to-house searches in the early hours of Wednesday when gunfire could be heard echoing around Bujumbura. A police spokesman said police officers were responding to grenade attacks. He says the criminals threw three grenades at police and our cops responded and killed five of them. The deaths are the latest in a wave of violence in Burundi, which has raised fears that the nation may be sliding back into ethnic conflict after emerging in 2005 from a 12-year civil war. Rwanda is set to vote next week on a constitutional amendment that will allow President Paul Kagame to run for a third term in 2017 and potentially remain in power until 2034. The Rwandan government announced late Tuesday that the referendum will be held on December 17th for Rwandans living abroad and December 18th for those living in Rwanda. The referendum asked for approval of a proposed amendment that would shorten presidential terms to 5 years rather than seven. Democratic Republic of Congo loses up to $15 billion a year due to fraud, according to the president's anti-corruption advisor. He spoke Wednesday and said the amount close to twice the Central African country's budget. Luzolo Bambi is a counselor to President Joseph Kabila on graft and money laundering. He did not give specifics in an interview with a local radio station, but said corruption existed. This is VOA News. A new report finds a marked decrease in fighting between Ukrainian forces and Russian-backed rebels in the eastern part of the country. But the United Nations Human Rights Office, which issued the report, is expressing concern about the increase of abuses against civilians in the areas of Donetsk and Luhansk. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN finds a dramatic drop in the number of civilian casualties between mid-August and mid-November. During this reporting period, it says 47 people were killed and 131 wounded. Since war between the government and Russian-backed rebels in eastern Ukraine broke out in mid-April 2014, more than 9,000 people have been killed and nearly 21,000 wounded, according to the report. The report notes fewer people are dying in large-scale and indiscriminate shelling of populated areas in Donetsk and Luhansk. New casualties result mainly from explosive remnants of war and improvised explosive devices. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A U.S. official added to the criticism of Russia's military campaign in Syria, saying Wednesday that only 30% of Russian airstrikes have targeted Islamic State militants. U.S. Envoy Brent McGurk, who met with U.S. and Iraqi military leaders in Baghdad Wednesday, said the other 70% of Russia's airstrikes in Syria have hit opposition groups. Western nations have accused Russia of focusing its strikes on Syrian opposition fighters in support of its ally, President Bashar al-Assad. It's a charge that Russian officials have denied. Hundreds of people are leaving the last rebel-held section of the central Syrian city of Homs Wednesday as part of a local peace deal with the government. In addition to opposition fighters leaving, hundreds of civilians are also boarding buses out of the area. Once those rebel fighters leave, the Syrian government will be in full control of Homs. French officials say they've identified the third attacker who died in the attacks on a Paris Bataclan concert hall November 13th. Officials announced Wednesday that the attacker was from Strasbourg in eastern France and believed to have traveled in Syria in late 2013. The French media have identified him as 23-year-old Fouad Mohamed Akkad through a DNA match. Time magazine Wednesday named German Chancellor Angela Merkel its Person of the Year for 2015. This is Time editor Nancy Gibbs.
Chancellor Angela Merkel is our 2015 Person of the Year. And in a year where world leaders were tested all through the year, no one was tested the way she was.
The magazine said the German chancellor stepped in every time a serious crisis had threatened European statecraft this year. I'm Francis Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Kenya's interior minister says reports of an alleged mass grave discovered in northeastern Kenya earlier this week are false.
That's Mohamed Yusuf reporting from Nairobi. Details coming up. Also in the news, the World Health Organization has deployed an emergency response team to Ethiopia, which is facing its worst drought in decades. And President Muhammadu Buhari has reportedly said he could extend his December deadline for Nigeria's military to defeat Boko Haram. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Algeria, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry announced today that Washington will double the size of its grants to help developing nations adapt to climate change. Kerry said grants totaling $860 million will be available to deal with hurricanes, heavy rains, and floods over the next 3 years. The money will be part of an existing promise by wealthy countries to jointly mobilize $100 billion a year by 2020 in a climate finance. It will help fund domestic weather services and tracking systems to better assist poorer nations in forecasting and coping with extreme weather. Kerry made the announcement in a speech to the climate conference outside Paris. Various groups seeking to cut greenhouse gas emissions are at COP21. They're holding talks with like-minded NGOs and policy makers on how to make progress. Heather Allen is with the Partnership on Sustainable Low-Carbon Transport. VOA's Kim Lewis talked with Ms. Allen about her group's mission.
I work on sustainable transport with the Paris Process on Mobility and Climate, which is part of the Sustainable Low Carbon Transport Partnership. And we've made a partnership with Michelin Challenge Bibendum to bridge that gap between the private sector and the public sector. So we're a not-for-profit, but we really have worked on bringing the transport community together under this PPMC, this Paris Process on Mobility and Climate. And one of the things that we really see is that there is not enough engagement in this whole process on transport. Transport is going to really deliver part of the climate change benefits. And at the moment, it is the sector that is, the emissions from the sector are growing fastest. So now they are around a quarter of all energy-related emissions come from transport worldwide. So in the future, obviously, a lot of the developing world is going to want to build their economies, and they need to do this via transport. Transport has this way of bringing the economic development and economic benefits to everybody, but this must be done in a sustainable and climate-friendly way.
And also, how do you get young people interested in going about doing this?
So it's really important that the young people realize this connection of transport and climate change. And that's part of the reason why we've put together this session. So we've got a three-hour session today here at COP21. And we're bringing together not only a lot of young people who will be presenting on the panel, including our superhero from Mexico. He's going to be here on Skype, which is a very low-carbon way of presenting it at conferences. We're going to play a game around transport called Transport Bingo. We're going to try and engage much more with the youth. We've got a message from the UN Youth Envoy about how transport and youth can grow together. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to bring all the different solutions and opportunities that there are for youth to engage better with the transport community on the one hand, because it's not a very easy community to engage with, and that's why we've tried to federate the sector a little bit. And secondly, that, as we mentioned before, you know, none of the wind farms can be built unless the construction materials are transported to these places. None of the other aspects that will go on with different sectors can really be fully utilized in the climate actions unless transport is at the heart of it.
And what do you hope to gain from this COP21?
Well, I've been working on this issue since COP9, and I've seen a huge, huge amount of progress on that. In COP9, when the transport sector kind of reared its head, everyone said, what are you doing here? Huh? You're part of the energy world. If we fix energy, we'll fix transport. So I now see here in COP21, we've had over 30 different side events. We have organized a huge and very successful LPAA focus on transport. We have 15 initiatives from the sector committing to decarbonize and improve the emission profile of the sector. This is all incredible. So I feel that transport is no longer the forgotten orphan of energy as it was 10 years ago, and it's now beginning to take its proper place within the climate negotiations.
That was VOA's Kim Lewis at the COP21 conference in Paris. She was speaking with Heather Allen of the Partnership on Sustainable Low-Carbon Development. The World Health Organization has deployed an emergency response team to Ethiopia, which is facing its worst drought in decades. It warns food insecurity could worsen multiple epidemics and put millions at risk. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
The World Health Organization says Ethiopia is facing its worst drought in 30 years. But the humanitarian group Save the Children goes even further, calling it the worst in 50 years. Ethiopia has had two poor growing seasons this year due to delayed rains. Dr. Michelle Geyer is the WHO's Director of Emergency Risk Management and Humanitarian Response.
The crisis in Ethiopia has been triggered by El Nino. This weather phenomenon basically triggered drought in large parts of Ethiopia and flooding in other parts. As a result of this, there's been a huge amount of food insecurity in the country and malnutrition and displacement of populations as a result.
That makes people more vulnerable to communicable or infectious diseases.
Malnutrition, for example, in children increases the fact that someone will catch a disease and get pneumonia or diarrhea or malaria, but it also increases the severity of the disease, which means that children, if not seen very quickly, will die very quickly.
The WHO estimates that 400,000 children in Ethiopia will face severe malnutrition in 2016. Another 1 million children and about 700,000 pregnant or breastfeeding women are expected to face moderate malnutrition. Dr. Geyer says there are several disease outbreaks now underway in the country.
These include measles, watery diarrhea because of issues related to poor water and sanitation. There's already meningitis going on. There are cases of dengue fever, and there are almost 250,000 cases of scabies.
The WHO's emergency response team is lending its support to Ethiopia's Ministry of Health.
We have deployed to try and support the Ministry of Health to scale up operations in the country so that we can, with the ministry as well as partners in health, make sure that we can actually deliver health services, so primary health care and hospital care, for all these children that need medical care when they become very severely malnourished and develop these diseases.
The WHO ranks emergencies on a scale of 1 to 3, with 3 being the highest. Syria and Iraq are grade 3. Ethiopia is currently a grade 2. The WHO says the 1982-84 food crisis in Ethiopia was the most severe ever recorded and was attributed to the effects of El Nino and war. During that time, famine struck Ethiopia. Hundreds of thousands died, but millions suffered. Much has been done since then to avoid a repeat of that tragedy, including early warning systems and a better understanding of climate change and weather patterns. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Kenya's interior minister says reports of an alleged mass grave discovered in northeastern Kenya earlier this week are false. Mohamed Yusuf has the story from Nairobi.
Speaking to reporters in Nairobi Wednesday, Kenya's interior minister Joseph Kaiseri said there is no mass grave in Mandera County near the Somali border. On Tuesday, government security agencies accompanied by the local leaders went to the area and excavated 15 sites.
I wish to inform the country and the world at large that nothing was found in any of those sites. Today, following insistence by the political leaders that people may have been buried deep into the ground, excavators have been brought in to site to dig for the bodies, and nothing was found.
The interior minister said a shallow grave was found that contained a woman's body, but say they don't know how she died.
She's alleged to have been a cook for Al-Shabaab in Bulahawa, and when Al-Shabaab was overrun or were rooted out of Bulahawa, she ran to Kenya, she ran to Mandera, and she started working in a job selling cheese.
The reports of the alleged mass grave had once again raised concerns about extrajudicial killings. Human rights organizations have accused security agencies of killing and disappearing terror suspects as they hunt Al-Shabaab, something that security agencies deny. The state-funded Kenya National Commission on Human Rights said in April it had found mass graves that contained 11 people in Wajir County, also in the northeast. The Interior Ministry has called on leaders from Mandera County, who alleged the existence of mass graves this week, to issue an apology. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Rwandans are scheduled to vote on December 18th on whether to let President Paul Kagame run for a third term. The referendum will decide whether the constitutional limit of two terms can be changed. Mr. Kagame, who's 58, has served as president since 2000. A change in the constitution could permit him to run for three more consecutive terms in office, ending in 2034. Mr. Kagame recently said he would not make a decision until after the referendum. Major donor countries such as the United States have opposed a change in the Constitution. Seventeen past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. As registration of refugees in Germany nears 1 million this year, Chancellor Angela Merkel has been named Person of the Year by the U.S. weekly news magazine Time. The magazine's editors selected the German leader for her role in the European Union's migrant crisis. Time's editor says Germany has welcomed refugees as casualties of radical Islamist savagery, not carriers of it. Germany's interior minister says his country has registered more than 964,000 asylum seekers in the first 11 months of the year. Only a few of the 28 member states of the EU have welcomed migrants in recent months. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees says it is the duty of all 47 members of the Council of Europe to offer asylum. Antonio Guterres says granting asylum is an international law and a fundamental value of the European nations. Meanwhile, 12 migrants drowned today when a wooden boat carrying about 50 people began to fall apart and sink shortly after leaving the Turkish coast. Six of the dead are children. At least 12 people are still missing. Niger is planning to return about 500 Boko Haram prisoners to Nigeria in order to relieve its overcrowded prisons. The prisoners are being held in Kolo, Kotokali, and Difa, a city near the Nigerian border. The transfer has been planned in cooperation with the Nigerian military. Difa has been under attack many times by Boko Haram militants based in Nigeria. It has been placed under a state of emergency and a night curfew during the violence. President Muhammadu Buhari has reportedly said he could extend his December deadline for Nigeria's military to defeat Boko Haram. The military says progress has been made, but the group is still carrying out hit-and-run attacks in Nigeria and neighboring countries. VOA's Chris Stein reports from Lagos.
Defense spokesman Rabe Abubakar says the military has cleared Boko Haram militants out of territory they once held and degraded their capabilities. But he said troops cannot prevent attacks on bus stations and marketplaces.
Suicide bombing and other attack on sub-targets is something which no military can overnight wipe out.
The Borno state capital, Maiduguri, has been hard hit by the group's six-year quest to impose strict Islamic law in Nigeria's north. Eight people were killed late last month when a suicide bomber attacked a crowd of displaced people that were traveling into the city. But resident Aliyu Biu says the city has overall become safer.
You see, presently, we sleep with our eyes closed. We move along the highways, no blockades. We no longer experience people going into houses to slaughter people. We don't experience gunshots. Right, left, and center.
But two soldiers deployed about 50 kilometers away from Maiduguri told VOA the insurgents still control three local government areas of Borno State. The soldiers said they lack ammunition and adequate weaponry to fight the militants. Nigeria's military has long been dogged by complaints that its soldiers are ill-equipped to defeat the insurgency. Last month, authorities charged the National Security Advisor under former President Goodluck Jonathan with money laundering. Buhari has accused the former security advisor of stealing billions of dollars meant to equip the country's soldiers. Boko Haram is not a threat to Nigeria alone. Cameroon and Niger continue to report attacks in border areas. And at least 27 people died last week in suicide bombings in Chad, targeting a market on an island in Lake Chad. Coordinating regional efforts remains a challenge. Troops from Niger, Chad, and Cameroon launched operations against Boko Haram in early 2015. However, they are supposed to be transformed into an internationally backed regional force with Nigeria and joined by troops from Benin. That force is still not operational. Senior research fellow at the South Africa-based Institute for Security Studies, David Zunmeno, says deployment has been hobbled by the plunging price of crude, which is vital to both Chad and Nigeria's economies, as well as distrust between the region's leaders. But he warns failing to deploy the force would only aid the insurgency.
It will be a big blow and of opportunities to Boko Haram and other radical groups that African leaders are not really serious about challenging them.
Boko Haram has forced 2.1 million people out of their homes. Many fear to go home because of continued insecurity and loss of homes and jobs in retaken territory in the northeast. Boko Haram violence killed over 6,000 people last year, according to the Global Terrorism Index, and by all accounts, the group has killed several thousand more in 2015. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
The number of guinea worm disease cases in South Sudan is going down. Only 5 cases were registered by health officials this year, compared to more than 70 cases last year. The Carter Center, which runs a guinea worm eradication program in South Sudan, says it has made significant progress towards eradicating the disease by next year. But there is a long way to go before South Sudan is declared guinea worm free. Philip Tonaliu reports from Juba.
The Carter Center, the charity founded by former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, the South Sudan Health Ministry, and other organizations are holding a two-day conference beginning today here in Juba to review efforts to eradicate guinea worm in the country. Daniel Madit is the Carter Center Guinea Worm Eradication Program Coordinator for Lagos State's Awaria County, where one case of the disease was confirmed this year. Madit says his team conducts community awareness program on the importance of keeping sources of drinking water clean.
What we do tell to the community is to filter the water, not to drink the water directly from the pond. They have to use a closed filter to filter the water, and then they have to drink a clean water so that they can be safe from getting guinea worm disease.
Madir says local communities are encouraged to drink water from boreholes, which he admits are scarce in South Sudan.
There are no boreholes. The tool that we use to keep the water clean is a closed filter and 5 filter called cattle keepers. Actually, some people, they don't use a closed filter correctly. when they send small children to collect the water, they misplace the filter so that the filter will fall into the water. Then the insects are also entered. So when you drink that water, then you will still be contaminated because it's not being filtered correctly.
Madid says the shortage of borehole in Awerial County communities explains why new cases of guinea worm continue to be reported in that part of Lagos State. Eastern Equatoria, Werap, and Western Barra-Gazala states are the other parts of the country where cases of the disease have been reported in the recent past, despite enormous efforts by the Carter Center to eradicate the disease. Officials say 58 of last year's 70 reported guinea worm cases were in Eastern Equatorial State. This year, only 5 cases of the disease have been reported, with one in Eastern Equatorial State. Margaret Eto is Eastern Equatorial State's health minister.
We took it as a responsibility of everyone in the state to talk about it. So the community awareness is the most important, which we took it as really our priority. Last year, we launched the community-based disease surveillance. That is to make sure that even at the community level, at the household level, we train our members, community, who will be working from door to door to educate the people, because we realize there is a gap.
Ito says training 2,500 home health promoters and digging more boreholes in the state has been critical toward reducing the number of new guinea worm cases. She says now the focus is on eliminating the disease in 2016.
Actually, I'm looking at zero. Even this case of this year is a surprise because we really want to talk about zero in 2015. However, I think to me one is like almost talking about zero. We have really done our best, and really I say congratulations to Eastern Equatorial State.
Eto acknowledges that some communities have no access to clean drinking water, a major hindrance toward efforts to eradicate guinea worm. Human beings contract guinea worm when they drink water contaminated with guinea worm labor. McCoy Samuel Yivi, director for the Carter Center's South Sudan Guinea Worm Eradication Program, says he is encouraged by what has been achieved so far, but says much more must be done.
In fact, as reported, we have barely around 41% of endemic villages having access to safe water. And even these villages that have access to safe water, sometimes there is frequent breakdown of the boreholes.
Craig Wezas, acting vice president of health programs for the Carter Center, says those efforts should continue.
And we must be aware of one obstacle which is a threat to the program, complacency. Success breeds complacency. Complacency breeds failure.
In 2006, the year the Carter Center launched its guinea worm eradication program in South Sudan, it documented more than 20,000 cases of the disease in the country. The country has come a long way since then. But health officials say they will not be certified until the country is declared guinea worm free. For VOA News, I am Philip Tonaleo in Juba.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America. For listeners on VOA Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up next right here on the Voice of America. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, democracy wins with a smooth transition of power in Burkina Faso. President-elect Roch Marc Christian Kabore soundly defeated the opposition in the first free and competitive vote since independence. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss Burkina Faso's future under the new leadership of Kabore.
VOA News.
VOA. When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has announced the U.S. will double grants for poor nations to adapt to climate change. The World Health Organization has deployed an emergency response team to Ethiopia, which is facing its worst drought in decades. And President Muhammadu Buhari has reportedly said he could extend his December deadline for Nigeria's military to defeat Boko Haram. Coming up, music from Algeria. And in our feature segment, the third part of a series on South Africans making a difference. I'm Yehiz Wuhib and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday, Yehias.
I understand you're kicking off with African football.
Yehias, joining us once again on the sunny side of sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sunny, from Johannesburg that is suffering from a severe heat wave at the moment.
And speaking of heat, David, the heat is rising in Senegal's capital, Dakar. As we speak, Senegal going up against Nigeria, the 1996 Olympic champion, and that will be followed by a match between Algeria and South Africa. At stake, berths in next year's Olympic men's football tournament. Senegal against Nigeria, David. How does that look?
You hit the nail on the head, Sonny, when you mentioned heat. In fact, I've written a column here in South Africa about this. I think it's disgraceful that they're kicking this match off at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The match has been played in the National Stadium in Dakar. They've got perfectly good floodlights, and I feel it should be more like a 5 p.m. kickoff. What happened, Sonny, is at the start of this tournament, two rounds of matches in both groups A and B, the first of the doubleheaders kicked off at 3 p.m. And I don't think it's a coincidence that by far the worst match so far, it was a Group B game between Algeria and Mali, was played at this ridiculous 3 p.m. The temperatures are touching 100 degrees Fahrenheit, which is just unbearable for footballers. And what happens is the play is reduced essentially to a walking pace. There's a lot of long kicks forward, far more in hope than in expectation. The level of football suffers as a result. Senegal, of course, Sonny, they're the hosts. They're far more used to these conditions than the Nigerians. And that could well give them a crucial edge. What's also interesting about Senegal and Nigeria is they do far better in the first half of games than in the second half. If you take Nigeria, the Dream Team 6, as they're known, they have scored all five of their group goals in the first half. They have not scored a single goal in the second half. And their defense in the first two matches conceded four goals in the second half. So they score in the first half, they concede in the second half. Senegal, they have scored, Sonny, four of their six goals in the first half and two in the second half. So it's going to be really interesting to see how this one pans out. But if only because of the weather conditions, and I'm assuming it's going to be the same baking hot conditions that we've seen throughout the tournament so far, that could well give the baby lions, as the Senegalese are known, a slight edge. Now, on the other hand, Sonny, it's an 8:30 in the evening kickoff for the South Africans and Algerians, and they will be thanking their lucky stars because you've got South Africa at the very southern tip of the continent where once the temperature gets up to the mid-80s Fahrenheit, the word heat wave starts coming off people's lips. And the Algerians, of course, they're at the top of the continent and they're now in the middle of their northern hemisphere winter. So I think if there were two teams that had to play earlier in the day, I think it's better that it's Senegal and Nigeria because they are a little bit more used to these basically inhumane conditions. South Africa, Algeria, an interesting one too, Sonny. You got the flair of the South Africans up against the organization of the Algerians. Now, we spoke about the fact that Senegal and Nigeria, they do a lot of their damage in the first half. It's quite the opposite with the Algerians. They've all scored their goals in the final quarter of matches. They don't score in the first three quarters of a game. They simply defend, and where the Algerians are very dangerous is these quick counterattacks. I've noticed all three of the goals have come from counterattacks down the left flank, and one assumes that the South Africans have picked this up in watching the videos and will be particularly wary of that. The South Africans, similar situation, Sonny. They've only scored one first-half goal and four in the second half. And given the weather, I wonder if that's also not a coincidence. The fact that they've got maybe more energy when the weather is a little bit cooler, they attack more, and they scored four of their five goals in the second half. So two fascinating matches at stake, of course, two tickets to the Rio Olympics. And then on Saturday, Sonny, a very bizarre situation where you've got a final and a third-place match. And the third-place match, which is normally of very little relevance, that is going to completely overshadow the final. The final will have two teams that have already qualified for the Rio Olympics. On the other hand, the third-place match will decide the third and final team. And I want to stress that there's been a little bit of confusion in Africa. Because four African teams competed at London's 2012 Olympics, there was a belief it would be four again. It is, in fact, only three. Three teams only going to Rio from Africa. So the winner of the third-place playoff, which is the curtain raiser to the final, they will be the third and final qualifier.
Voice of America!
My Voice of America colleague from Uganda, Douglas Mpuga, cheering and smiling over his beloved Cranes. The Cranes lifted their record-extending 14th CECAFA title over the weekend, David. How about some details?
Yes, Sonny, it's all going right for Uganda at the moment, the Cranes of Uganda. They are undoubtedly the top team in Eastern Central Africa this year. If you look at the rankings, Sonny, they're the only East African country in the top 20 in Africa in the FIFA rankings. They're also the only East African country that have qualified for the group stage of the World Cup for 2018 in Russia. And then just to cap it all and to show the depth of their talent, their coach, Milutin Shredovic, he took what was basically a young experimental side to Ethiopia for the CECAFA Cup, which is the Eastern Central Africa Championship. And lo and behold, they emerged winners despite losing their first match in the group stage, 2-0 to Kenya. And emphasizing youth, the captain of the side was none other than 18-year-old Farouk Mia, a name we're beginning to mention quite regularly on the Sunny Side of Sport. He's a midfielder. He's got a fondness for scoring goals. And I'm sticking my neck out and saying this is a star of the future. We don't at the moment, actually, Sonny, have any Ugandan stars in Europe. We don't have them in the English Premier League or La Liga. And maybe Mia is the man that's going to break that drought. And in a couple of years' time, once he's developed some more, he could well be playing in Europe. But it's quite something. I don't know of many 18-year-olds who captain their national teams. If we look at the knockout stages, Uganda beat Malawi 2-0 in the quarterfinals. In the semifinals, they drew 0-0 with Ethiopia and won 5-3 on penalties. And then in the final against Rwanda, a team that Shredovic formerly coached, it was a header from Okuti after 15 minutes that was decisive. The final result there, Uganda won, Rwanda 0. And in the third place playoff between Ethiopia and Sudan, it finished 1-1, and the Ethiopians won 5-4 on penalties. That's a word I keep using, Sonny, penalties. In fact, of the eight knockout matches in the CECAFA Cup this year, six were decided by penalty shootouts. It was only the final and Uganda's quarterfinal victory that were won in regular time. Quite an amazing statistic that 75% of the quarterfinals, semifinals, third place and final matches were decided by penalty shootouts. You mentioned Uganda with their 14 titles. Next best are Kenya with six, then Ethiopia with four. Malawi, Sudan, and Tanzania have won the competition three times each. Zambia have won it twice. And Rwanda's B team, Zanzibar and Zimbabwe, have won it once each. And just to complete the statistics, Sonny, the leading scorer was Atar El Tahir from Sudan. He scored four goals, including a hat-trick against Zanzibar. So well done to Douglas. Well done to the Cranes. No argument, Sonny. Uganda are the kings of football in East and Central Africa.
No argument here, David. And we'll hear more soccer-licious commentary from David Legg later this week, right here on the Sunny Side of Sports.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America, VOA, Washington.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
In National Basketball Association news, the defending champion Golden State Warriors have won their record-extending 23rd game in a row to start the season. The Warriors beat the host Indiana Pacers Tuesday night, 131-123. Guard Klay Thompson scored a game-high 39 points for the Warriors, while backcourt partner and reigning league MVP Stephen Curry tallied 29 points. The win moves the Warriors into a second-place tie among the NBA's all-time winning streaks. Having won the final four regular season games of last season before their record 23-0 start to this season, the Warriors equaled the 2012-2013 Miami Heat's 27-game winning streak. The 1971-72 Los Angeles Lakers hold the NBA record of 33 wins in a row. The International Boxing Federation has stripped Tyson Fury of its heavyweight title for refusing to fight a mandatory challenger, and the big British boxer is also under investigation for alleged hate crimes over comments he made before beating former heavyweight champion Vladimir Klitschko November 28th. The IBF actions are not related to Fury's controversial comments. The sanctioning body wanted Fury to fight its mandatory challenger, Vyacheslav Glazkov of Ukraine, but Fury is expected to have a rematch instead in 2016 against Klitschko, who's also from Ukraine. Meanwhile, in Manchester, England, where Fury lives, police are looking into comments he made against homosexuals. In last month's bout, Fury took Klitschko's WBA, WBO, and IBF belts, but he'll now have to make do with the first two, plus a much bigger payday for fighting Klitschko again than he would have for fighting Glazkov. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to you, Hayes Woohee.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, a South African NGO offers musical training to disadvantaged children. And next, a Zimbabwean raising awareness about people with disabilities. But first, some music. Here is Idir and Nadia from Algiers with Amon Pair.
Citoyen du monde. survie. Mon patrimoine, c'est pas toi, citoyenne, que je m'élève, c'est pour toi que je tais mes sentiments par amour pour ma foi et mon enfant.
Face à ton destin, n'oublie jamais que le respect sera toujours comme la racine de notre famille. Tu es ma fille.
À mon père, j'ai à dire tellement de choses. À mon père, cet homme.
Idira Nadia from Algiers with A Mon Père. South Africa abounds with musicians and is home to world-famous artists like Ladysmith Black Mambozo and Miriam Makeba. Yet, music lessons are no longer offered to the vast majority of children in the country's public schools. The government argues that music isn't a priority in education, but the Sidewalk Sessions initiative in Johannesburg begs to differ and is turning underprivileged children into budding performing artists. Darren Taylor reports in the third part of a series on South Africans making a difference.
Johannesburg pop group Lacey May. On guitar is Kelly Grevler, a highly accomplished young musician with university degrees in music performance and theory and music business. She's also finishing master's degrees in music neuroscience and music psychology.
It's very, very interesting. I'm obsessed with pop music, so I think it's quite a cool thing to look at how your brain works when you hear certain pop songs. So basically what I'm trying to figure out is, why do songs get stuck in the head? What is happening in the brain? And how can we better utilize that function to write better songs in the future? Let's go four times. One, two, three, four.
Grevler has long brown hair and wears bright red lipstick. She's in a white vest and jeans on a hot summer's day. Her arms are covered in colorful tattoos. She's teaching guitar to some children on a sidewalk under a tree in central Johannesburg. The session is their only music lesson each week.
It's the right thing to do, and what else would I be doing on a Sunday? You know, it's 1 hour. It's 1 hour a week. It's honestly the least I can do.
Grevler's pupils are poor. Some live in inner city buildings controlled by slumlords with no water and electricity. Some of the children are exposed to violence and abuse and often don't have food, let alone access to music lessons, which in South Africa are available only to the privileged few. Grevler gives them guitars to practice on, thereby injecting joy and skill into their lives.
I didn't choose to do this, it kind of chose me, and it's really fun. I think I have a little bit more fun than the kids usually. So, and I love teaching, I'm passionate about music education, and it's fun. This is such a cool way to give them a skill and maybe ignite a passion for something that they would have never explored otherwise, because they shut off to it at their schools.
Oh, yeah!
She says watching new students strum a guitar is always a thrill.
Oh, they love it, hey? So the first time is always my favorite because they're smiling and they're quite shocked that they can actually do it. They do actually have coordination and they can do it.
Open string. Grevler says some of her pupils, like the one she's instructing here, are lightning fast learners.
I cannot even fathom the talent in those two kids. Music is in them. I think that the little boy, he'll definitely do music as a career. That's what he wants to be, he wants to be a musician. Like, that's what he tells me. So it's really cool.
Grevler's proud that her students thrive despite their lack of resources. They bang on old guitars on a grubby pavement, seated on plastic chairs.
They are reading music. They are reading actual notes on music notation. It is so incredible, and this is very, it's very informal. We don't even have, you know, equipment. We don't have music stands. We've got little pieces of paper, and we just managed to do it. So
she plans to help some of her more successful pupils enroll in music schools. She says their enthusiasm knows no bounds, like one who recently doorstepped her.
And I walked out of my building, and one of my students, a little boy, ran up to me, ran across the street, ran up to me, And he says, you'll never believe what Father Christmas is bringing me for Christmas. So I was like, what? He's like, a guitar. And I just thought, like, out of everything this little 10-year-old could want for Christmas, he wants a guitar. Like, it's unbelievable. And he still comes. He didn't come today. I think they're all swimming.
Grevler says the children teach her much more than she teaches them.
Patience, more than anything. They want to be here. No one's telling them to come. They come and they learn and they remember. They remember everything I tell them. It's unbelievable. This informal teaching environment actually works, which is amazing.
She says her students aren't shy to demand that she teaches them very specific songs on guitar.
We always do Rihanna songs. They absolutely love Rihanna. We tried to do a Nicki Minaj song once, but there's way too much swearing, so I banned that song, not happening.
Tourists stare and some film and take photos of Grevler's protégés as they perform Rihanna's hit song, Diamonds. She says she has no doubt that some of them will be professional music artists in the near future. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
A Zimbabwean man who's now based in South Africa is raising awareness about people with disabilities. Simon Manda is the co-founder and managing editor of This Ability newspaper, which he says is decided to create as a platform for people with disabilities. Manda tells VOA reporter Ndimiaki Mwakalielie that people with disability should not be looked as victims.
2011, we came together in Durban. I realized that there was no media platform that was talking mainstream disability issues. Because basically, there are two extremes, the upper the level and the superhero level of a disability, like how they elevated Oscar Pretorius and other news medias who talk about the sadness of disability. So we wanted to showcase that in between, there's somebody living an everyday life, achieving in their own space, despite any impairment they might have, but basically informing the world that what's wrong with the world is not an impairment, but the disabling environment that we find in society. Not being accessible or inclusive enough for people to participate socio-economically in platforms.
So what kind of impact are you hoping to make through this newspaper?
You want to teach a majority about a minority. So what you do it in small steps. You talk about the ability that somebody has so that they understand that, oh, okay, this is also a person, but despite any impairment, they can do 1, 2, 3, and can't do 3, 4, 5. So that's how we came to be.
And you also mentioned about how some of your focus is to empower people who are living with disabilities.
Basically, it's about disability mainstreaming. And when you say disability mainstreaming, is creating platforms that everybody can access. Everybody. You know, disabled people or non-disabled people. So that's the campaign to say from where we are, society is almost like wronged, and we were looking at a medical perspective, and this is how it came about. After World War II, people had broken limbs, people had no legs because of the war. And society said, let's take care of these people by putting them in homes and take care of them. But these people, they were not contributing to society. Then they feel they were not needed, and hence a high death rate due to suicide and just not being part of society. So another model had to be created, which was the social model. The social model looks at the enabling environment that says, there are people with disabilities, but how can they be included into society and platforms so that they can also be participate and actively contribute to an economy? So if we begin to work with the social model, it becomes easier.
Listening to this interview, somebody might think, well, you're so vested in the issues of people with disabilities because maybe you have a disability, but you don't. You don't have a disability. So how are you, or what made you become so interested in helping people with a disability, which obviously you can't relate to personally?
It's not helping. It's moving together, because we all people at the end of the day, you're not defined by your disability, but you're defined by your humanity. So that's how it goes.
Now, you operate out of South Africa, and how does that translate into the enabling that you're trying to do for your fellow citizens in Zimbabwe?
The vision obviously got well embedded in South Africa, and I'm trying to look at different programs that can be emulated elsewhere. I've had an opportunity to meet Prudence Mabena. Her documentary based on her life story won an Oscar award, and not many people know this. I appointed her as one of the Casual Day Ambassadors. I run the program for the National Council for Persons with Physical Disabilities in South Africa. So South Africa would be sort of creating a good product that will replicate elsewhere, obviously according to the needs of that country.
Simon Manda, the co-founder and managing editor of This Ability newspaper, which he publishes from South Africa. He spoke with reporter Ndimiaki Muakalielie. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Corruption is one of the world's greatest challenges. It is often an abuse of power at a local level that affects all of us on a global scale. It negatively impacts rich and poor countries alike in both the private and public sectors. Corruption destroys trust, undermines development, erodes confidence in democratic institutions, and prepares the way for transnational criminal activities. Ultimately, it is the ordinary people that suffer the consequences. Corruption distorts markets, causes higher prices, discourages investors, and stunts economic growth. It is particularly destructive to communities in developing countries, where it acts as a block to development and progress. To call attention to this scourge, 12 years ago, the United Nations designated December 9th as International Anti-Corruption Day. The day has been observed annually since 2003, coinciding with the adoption of the United Nations Convention Against Corruption by the UN General Assembly. Crucially, the UN Convention recognizes that corruption is a crime that transcends communities and national borders. It fuels criminal activities at home and across the globe. A comprehensive approach is needed, one involving cooperation among governments, civil society, and the private sector. Ending corruption depends on transparency in government and the rule of law, and ensuring that citizens everywhere, as individuals, journalists, and members of civil society, are able to expose corrupt practices and press for the prosecution of perpetrators. The United States stands ready to work with other nations to bring corrupt individuals to justice, whether through technical assistance and training or working cooperatively to find evidence or stolen assets held abroad. Working together, we can ensure the integrity of our markets, improve our government institutions, and increase opportunity and prosperity for all our citizens.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, democracy wins with a smooth transition of power in Burkina Faso. President-elect Roch Marc Christian Kabore soundly defeated the opposition in the first free and competitive vote since independence. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss Burkina Faso's future under the new leadership of Kabore.